Robinson versus the City of Harvey. Mr. DeCiannini.
Good morning. May it please the court. Thomas G. DeCiannini on behalf of the defendant, City of Harvey. I am before you to argue what is what we hope one of the final phases of a long and torturous history. We submit that this case is one which, like so many cases like it, is the result of the tail wagging the dog, where the litigation was essentially driven by fees and little more.
But I would appreciate it, this won't surprise you, if you could begin with the jurisdictional issue. There certainly is appellate jurisdiction to review the attorney's fees order here.
Yes.
But I'm very concerned that there is, in fact, no appellate jurisdiction over the underlying entry of judgment.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that there are three different, very strong arguments for why this court has appellate jurisdiction. Certainly, it's not your traditional case in which a notice of appeal is filed within 30 days of the judgment, so that there's no question. But we believe that there are three separate bases, all arguments we've made in our briefs, which support the conclusion that there's jurisdiction. The first is that under Rule 58, a motion was filed, which under Appellate Rule 4A4A results in the tolling of the time to file the appeal until the last of the pending motions was decided.
I'm not sure that that's how I read those rules together. You file the motion for attorney's fees, which you're entitled to file under Rule 54, in 14 days. And remember, under Rule 6, 14 days really means 14 days. It's only 10-day periods of time that skip weekends. So it's actually a very similar amount of time to filing a 59 motion. And the I'm not sure I read the tolling rules in the same way that you argue they operate in your brief.
Well, Rule 4A4A says that one of the motions that will toll the time for the filing of a notice of appeal is a motion under Rule 58 when a timely motion for fees has been filed under Rule 54.
Now, I know, but you see, your system would require appeals to reinvigorate, if you will. And after the time period, see, the purpose of that part of Rule 4 of the appellate rules is if somebody filed an early notice of appeal, it was able to sit there and come into being, let's say, when the Rule 59 motion was finally ruled on. It has nothing to do with being able to file a notice of appeal after the time for appeal has expired.
Well, Rule 4A4 does not contain that type of limiting language. Now, I think we need to keep in mind that the Northern District has chosen to not follow the 14-day rule that's in
Rule
54.
Well, that's right.
It allows such motions in 90 days.
And it says we aren't doing anything, as they certainly have no power to do, to affect times for appeal. I think that's just because the Northern District has weighed the balance in and decided that a cooperative process on attorney's fees is so often useful that even though people will have to file two separate notices of appeal, so be it. You know, they'll have to file the two separate notices of appeal, and this court will consolidate the appeals if we want to, which, of course, is our normal practice when that happens.
Your Honor, I think that the purpose of Rule 4A4A is to be extremely practical. There is a practicality here that showed itself. The only reason that the merits appeal was taken in this case was because there was an exorbitant, in our view, fee award, very common.
But wait a minute. I mean, 4A4A3 only covers attorney's fees if the district court extends the time to appeal under Rule 58. It doesn't in any, I see nothing in that language that suggests that the mere filing of an attorney's fee petition within the time period that the district court gives you, as opposed to within this 14-day period that Rule 54 D talks about. There's nothing in that language to suggest that you have more than 60 days to file a time appeal.
No, but the district court did, under Rule 58, enter an order extending the time.
Not within the first 30 days,
no,
though.
No, but they couldn't have.
But
they
because you had no power to. District courts can't just extend time to appeal randomly.
Well, they also couldn't. Well, I'm not so sure about that. It's not random. It's not randomly. But Rule 58 doesn't allow a Rule 58 extension of time until there's been a fee petition filed. There's a dichotomy in the rules that can only be explained in the way that we believe it should be explained.
Well, but listen, let's look at Rule 4A5, which addresses motions for extension of time.
Yes.
That specifies when the district court can extend the time to file a notice of appeal. And unless there's excusable neglect or good cause, it has to happen no later than 30 days after the time prescribed by the rule has expired. I mean, there are limits on these orders that are in the rule.
That is in the absence. I submit that Rule 4A5 applies in the absence of another motion that would allow the court or that would result in the court.
It doesn't say that, though.
Well, 4A4 doesn't say that it's subject to Rule 4A5.
It says timely, and then 4A5 addresses timely. First you have 4A1, that's the first thing it has to say about timely. You certainly don't qualify for that. And then 4A5 is how you might change the time. I don't see any reason to pull that word timely out of 4A4.
Well, no. 4A4 says, if a party timely files in the district court any of the following motions, the time to file an appeal runs for all parties. Now, if you go to 4, I'm sorry,
3.
If you go to 3,
for attorney's fees under Rule 54, if the district court extends the time to appeal. And I'm saying that when the district court here extended the time to appeal, it was too late. There was no ability to do that at that point. If the district court had ruled within the 30 days, and then besides, extensions can't exceed 30 days anyway. I mean, you're just sort of caught coming and going, I think.
I think what you're doing, though, is you're imposing 4A5 as a limitation on 4A4.
Absolutely,
which would also vitiate Rule 58 completely.
No, it doesn't vitiate Rule 58 at all.
It does in the Northern District.
Well, that's because the Northern District, no one forces you to have one appeal. The Northern District just says you're going to have to file two notices of appeal.
Well, Your Honor, with all due respect, we do disagree with that reading of the rule. And we think that if one rule...
I can't believe the Northern District of Illinois has the power to override times for appeal when we regard these as jurisdictional. We dismiss appeals all the time for coming in late.
I don't believe they're overriding it. Rule 58, I mean, I think Federal Rules of Civil Procedure have to be construed consistently with the appellate rules, and Rule 58 allows for courts to extend the time or to create longer periods, longer deadlines for the filing of a fee motion. It doesn't say it must be done within 30 days. It allows longer motions. I mean, I think the only way, I submit to the court, the only way to give effect to Rule 58, Rule 54, and Federal Rule of Appellate Rule 4A3, 4A43, is to construe it the way that we're saying it does. I don't see a rule anywhere that says that once a time to appeal would have expired absent the later filing of a motion that under Rule 4A4 would now reinvigorate, as you say, the time to appeal, where that would be precluded. I mean, I think that 4A5...
It's just completely against every case I've ever seen. I mean, under your system, if it takes people a year to resolve attorney's fees, all of a sudden the 30-day period is ignored and suddenly we'll be seeing appeals?
Well, I think the district court would have to be convinced that that's the right thing to do.
Well, but there are rules about time for appeal, and I just don't see anything in Rule 58 about, indeed, I see things to the contrary. Judgments entered for purpose of these rules, entry of judgment may not be delayed. in order to tax costs or award fees except as provided in 58C2. You can go to 58C2. A timely motion. Court may act before a notice of appeal has been filed and has been made effective if you've got these time periods observed. But I don't see where that... Anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah, before
all your time,
is used up here. Let me ask you this. I think you're going to be in real trouble on the jurisdictional issues and reviewing the underlying granting of a new trial here on this inconsistent verdict thing. And even if you had appellate jurisdiction of that, I'm not so sure that you have a winner on that. I think those verdicts were inconsistent. But that said, you've got a little time to talk about the attorney's fees here, and I thought it was somewhat unusual that the attorney's fees for your side of the case actually exceeded the attorney's fees for the plaintiffs. Was unreasonable.
Yes, I would be happy to address that. Let me first say, though, that I'm a little troubled by the court's comment about jurisdiction, because I do think our second and third arguments are compelling as well.
An oral motion was made?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, you can use your time whichever way.
I will go to the fees. Once again, Your Honor, I think this case demonstrates what so many cases have said in the Supreme Court and in this court, and it's a dissatisfaction with the entire Lodestar process and how in some cases it just doesn't work. In this case, there was a request for over $700,000 in fees on a $25,000 compensatory verdict and an uncollectible punitive damages verdict.
Of course, I mean, it's a little misleading on your part to call it that. It's a $275,000 verdict, so it's not quite the minimal recovery you make it out to be.
Well, the district court thought it was significant. The district court saw the $25,000 as the extent of the success and the punitive damages portion of it, essentially uncollectible, which I believe it turned out to be. I think it was settled for some type of a nuisance. I don't know exactly what the settlement terms were. And we don't represent Officer Escalante and didn't down below. But what the district court did here was made a decision that a proper lodestar was about $500,000, $507,000, then reduced it under the Hensley post-lodestar adjustment for result obtained by a third, so by about $175,000. The plaintiff filed a motion to reconsider, and what the district court did at that point was to consider the complexity of the case in reinstating the one-third that they had reduced. And our view is that it is the results or the success in relation to what's demanded, et cetera, that entire Farrar-Hensley post-Lodestar issue that determines whether or not there should be an adjustment of the Lodestar. The plaintiff came in with affidavits and different information which were presented to the court to show that the case had more complexity than the district court initially appreciated. But the lack of success issue was not something that changed as a result of their motion to reconsider. The lack of success was an objective consideration that the court determined the first time around. And I guess the point would be that we never got our adjustment for lack of success, which the district court was obligated to do under Hensley. The one-third was reinstated not because the court reversed itself on the level of success obtained, but based on what the court now thought was a more complex case than originally it had anticipated. We think the plaintiff came away with an extremely handsome award after the one-third reduction. To reinstate the one-third reduction, we thought was unfair, deprived us of the post-Hensley adjustment, and
Here was that Judge Plunkett had to pick this case up after the prior judge had tried the case.
Yeah, she had to recuse herself because of a conflict.
And that's always a difficult situation.
Difficult on maybe on the Lodestar. difficult on determining how complex the litigation is, but really not difficult on gauging the level of success as opposed to the amount demanded. That, to me, is something that's very apparent from the record. So our point is that the judge did all the difficult things.
Well, being establishing that somebody planted evidence and tried to convict you as you were an innocent person, it's supposed to be our theme of the day, given the prior case. But
I noticed that. Yeah.
Proving that.
Probably not a good draw for me.
Is,
but
maybe not monetary success, but it certainly is a
well,
very important
The proof actually fell into the plaintiff's lap, but I think that all goes into the lodestar calculation, which we're not challenging. We would like to challenge, but the deferential standard is too high, so we're not. But I think that the adjustment standard, the adjustment requirement, is something this court can look at de novo, or I won't say de novo. It is an abuse of discretion, but at least it's easier for this court to take an objective look at that issue than it is to the line-by-line lodestar process. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lilly?
May it please the court, counsel, along with Arthur Lobey, we represent Archie Robinson, and the decision of the district court here should be affirmed. It should be affirmed because there is no jurisdiction over the appeal. The time for appeal ran 31 days after judgment was entered because no timely Rule 59 motion was filed. The appeal time wasn't told. 4 months after jurisdiction had vanished, they filed a Rule 58 motion asking the district court to recreate jurisdiction after it was already gone. The fee petition actually got lost in his argument, wasn't filed till a year after jurisdiction had.
So do you think if the fee petition had been filed within that first 30 days, we'd be looking at a different case?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Rule 58 has to mean something, and that's what it means. But it doesn't mean that a district court is empowered to recreate jurisdiction once it's vanished, only because they screwed up and didn't file a timely appeal, and they're looking for a creative way to get back in the game. If Your Honors were to delimit jurisdictional bars on that basis alone, there's cases in the district court where you're sitting there at a court call and they're calling a case from 1976 where they're doing a consent decree and they're monitoring. Under their theory, if they filed a fee petition 30 years after the fact, the district court could reopen the door to this court. And that's not the way jurisdiction works. It's not up to the district court. This court has rules that establish jurisdiction and they failed to follow them. The appeal is not timely. I give a little bit of argument to their oral Rule 59 motion, but that's frivolous. The district court termed it as such, and the district court was correct. What the district court said was, we're going to have a hearing, and then you're going to file a Rule 59 motion. It's clearly prospective, anticipatory, and the case law we cited in our brief is right on point that there is a such thing as saying, I'm going to file a Rule 59 motion, but that's not the same thing as an oral Rule 59 motion. And, of course, here, as we pointed out in our brief, Escalante himself disavowed the notion that he had filed an oral Rule 59 motion.
Can there be an oral Rule 59 motion?
As the district court put it, we don't need to file one. We don't need to reach that question because one was so obviously not reached here, made here. Although we did cite that fine case which said that, you know, motions have to be in writing unless they're during a trial. Rule 59 is not during a trial, so it would seem to me that you couldn't have an oral Rule 59 motion. Then, of course, there's their unique circumstances argument, equally frivolous. They're really blaming the district court for their own mistake, but that just doesn't hold up in light of the transcript. The defense attorney said, Judge, I got a vacation planned. I know it's a 10-day rule, but if they agree, we can extend the time. And all that Judge Lefkoe said is, if you're telling me that, you're telling me that. She didn't give them the type of assurance that tolling doctrine was based on. And, in fact, this court has narrowed that tolling doctrine to the point of almost non-existence. It certainly wouldn't apply in a case like a Rule 59 motion because there could be no justifiable reliance. Everybody knows that you got 10 days, and, in fact, their comments on the transcript suggest that they knew. So there is no jurisdiction. We don't have to reach the merits. If we did reach the merits, they've got a loser. There's no way to reconcile those two verdicts. Ordinarily, you might be able to reconcile excessive force with a UUW but for the malicious prosecution. But here, the excessive force claim was essentially a referendum on did he have a gun. The jury instruction that went back on the excessive force claim was, did Mr. Robinson pull a gun? It was phrased somewhat colloquially, but that was by agreement of the parties. The jury, having found that he did pull a gun, then you cannot simultaneously say that Escalante had no probable cause and maliciously started a prosecution for something that requires a gun. They don't fit. And more importantly, this court has traditionally afforded jurisdiction and discretion in the district court. This is the kind of issue, like an evidentiary issue, that this court lets district courts decide and will reverse only for an abuse of discretion. And there's clearly no abuse here. We're right on the merits, even if there was jurisdiction. That brings us to attorney's fees, Your Honor. And, you know, we have a very, very different view than them. They're giving you essentially, you know, the conventional defense wisdom. Oh, it's all about attorney's fees. This is an important case. This is a man who was accused of a very serious crime who absolutely didn't do it. He was shot by a police officer, and to justify an unjustified shooting, they put a gun on the ground. And, yes, the physical damages might not have interested enough attorneys to take this case, because he did have a wound that, you know, didn't cause him permanent injuries. But he ultimately recovered not just the $25,000, but the $250,000 in punitives. And Judge Plunkett, who wasn't there on the front lines, wrote in his first opinion, hey, it's uncollectible. That was wrong. We did a hearing after the trial, and we found out that Escalante, and all this is in the record, it's cited in our brief, had assets that exceeded the $250,000 in judgment. It surprised us, believe me, but he did have the assets. And we did settle the case, and the amount is confidential. But I can tell you here on the record that combining the two recoveries, it was a six-figure recovery, both Harvey and Escalante. That's not a nuisance recovery. In closing argument, they said to the jury, give him nuisance. The jury did not give Archie nuisance. Archie succeeded. He got exactly what plaintiff's counsel asked for in closing argument, $275,000. That's what I asked the jury to give. That's what the jury gave. This is not the exceptional case where you would say that the success here was so marginal that we're going to disturb the lodestar. And that's really the hurdle that they have to get over. They have to convince you, not if you were sitting there, what you would you disturb the lodestar? It's that the district court abused its discretion in awarding the lodestar, that the district court got it so terribly wrong in refusing to deviate downward by a third in the lodestar that this court should step in. There was no such abuse of discretion here, and they cannot overcome it. What he's really asking you to do is blow up the lodestar process. He's saying, for this kind of case, boy, it's not worth it. It's not worth it. Plaintiffs shouldn't be able to pursue it. That's his view, and it always irritates defense counsels that plaintiffs get paid at all. But that's not the law. The law is that if Archie Robinson suffered an egregious and serious civil rights violation, and he wants to attract competent counsel, that you're entitled to the lodestar. And frankly, they caught a big break. You know, we billed the same amount of hours as they billed. Judge Plunkett, notwithstanding, nonetheless, reduced our hours by 20%. He reduced our established billing rates by 19%. That became the lodestar. 20% less than they billed was our lodestar. What they're arguing is that the district court abused its discretion in not reducing that reduced amount by an additional third. And not only was that not error, it certainly wasn't egregious error that would justify disturbing the district court's verdict. And, you know, they talk about lack of success. They breezed right over the Monell claim. In Harvey, if people complained to the Harvey Police Department that their rights were violated, we proved at trial that the Harvey Police Department ignored those complaints. Invariably, uniformly, every time, people had medical corroboration. They had, you know, independent witnesses. And the city of Harvey, in its discretion, decided we're going to just ignore all complaints of excessive force. That was put to a jury, and this jury found the city of Harvey liable on a Monell claim, independently, non-derivatively, said Harvey is also on the hook for this judgment. They, too, are liable. That is a success. We prove that in a federal court. It's just the way the system's supposed to work. People have no voice in Harvey, but Harvey then had to come to court and try to justify its practices in court, and the jury wasn't buying it, and the jury found Harvey accountable. That too, justifies the success here. This, you know, we should be arguing, frankly, for an upward departure. We had a huge amount of success in an extremely difficult case. We are arguing that the Harvey Police Department engaged in a criminal conspiracy to plant the gun. All the witnesses were on their side. All the state's attorneys are fighting us. The Public Integrity Task Force and the discovery in this case found that the Public Integrity Task Force had never met a shooting that was not justified. that when we did the discovery in this case, they get, you know, the Public Integrity Task Force gets called in for small departments that don't have the resources to investigate a shooting. They step in, and every time they find a shooting justified, and then they create a packet of documents, witness statements, that, and then they hand it to Mr. DeCiani. Here, your shooting is justified. We had to undo the Public Integrity Task Force work. We had to combat three Public Integrity Task Force witnesses who came to trial and said that our witnesses were contradicting themselves and the police were consistent and the shooting was justified. We had to take on all the witnesses adversely because all the witnesses at the scene were police officers and they were all against us. I mean, he said in his, my opponent said in his oral argument that this fell into our lap. Nothing fell into our lap here. We had to work very hard and we had to do good work to prove that Archie Robinson was the victim of having a gun planted. We should be arguing for an upward departure. At the all what's really at stake here is whether we're entitled to the lodestar. And the only thing that's clearly established here is case after case after case after case that holds you're entitled to your lodestar. They're saying this court should deviate from the usual way, should get away from the lodestar rule, and should say, you know what, this case doesn't justify it. There's no reason to revisit not just this court's law, but the Supreme Court's law. This case, you know, I was put off by the argument that this is, you know, the mantra. This is the tail wagging the dog. This is a case that the defendants could have settled. You know, there was multiple settlement conferences. They took the position this is a frivolous case because Archie Robinson had a gun. They took the position that even if we won, this was a nuisance case because he didn't have what they were deeming compensable injuries. And they insisted that this was going to take 7 years, multiple summary judgment motions, multiple trials, all kinds of discovery. They wanted to go the long way. Well, that was their prerogative, but having done it that way, now they got to pay the lodestar. That's how the system works, and it's a good system.
Well, so, this public integrity group that you mentioned, where is that? What governmental body funds that, or where does that come from?
It's an outfit of the Illinois State Police. And I can't say either way whether they have since found shootings justified, but all the discovery we've ever done, they've never met a shooting where the police weren't right. Thank you for your time. If nobody has any further questions.
Mr. DeCiani, I think your time had expired, but you may have a minute because there was some extensive questioning.
Well, all right. I will just quickly respond. First of all, the lodestar was reduced because counsel had multiple attorneys at practically every event. They had five lawyers at the trial. That's why the lodestar was reduced. And we're not challenging the lodestar. We're challenging the post-lodestar reduction, which we believe that we're entitled to. We're not asking this court in this case to blow up the lodestar system. That may be an argument made sometime in some other case. Cases have already talked about that possibility, but we're not asking for that in this case. We do think, though, we were entitled to a post-lodestar adjustment. Now, counsel has talked about settlement, what went on during settlement, what they recovered from Mr. Robinson outside of, Mr. Escalante outside of this case. None of that is of record. There were multiple settlement conversations. The problem was that counsel held us up because he could in this case, particularly after the first trial was vacated. We made generous settlement offers, but Seventh Circuit, this court has held that non-record settlement discussions should not be considered in fee limitation cases.
But you could always make an offer of judgment.
You could have made could make an offer of judgment. None of that happened in this case. So,
and that cuts off attorney's fees, yes, after the offer of judgment,
yes,
is expired.
One final point. I would really ask the court to take a good look at the unique circumstances argument here and the oral motion argument here. First of all, we didn't screw up. Never mind. There was a very unusual circumstances that led to that post-trial remitter business. And it's because the district court didn't let Escalante put in evidence of net worth. So the whole thing had to be done after the verdict. And it was understood. It was understood throughout the trial. It was understood after the verdict came back. It was understood during those early hearings that there was going to be a hearing for the purposes of determining remitter of the punitive damages award based on net worth. It was absolutely understood that those comments are made over and over again by Escalante's attorneys. When are we going to have the hearing on the remitter? Let's do it next week. No, I'm on vacation. Let's do it the week after that. There have been cases that have held that oral motions are sufficient. And we think unique circumstances in this case extend not just to the district court saying that the time to appeal is preserved, but also to the district court acknowledging that the oral comments made on the record would serve as the motion for the remitter. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.